Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today, we're diving deep into a really foundational text for Kurdish historical writing.
That's right, the Sheriff Name, also known as the Book of Honor, by Sheriff Feksani Bidlisi.
It's a huge work and, well, quite significant.
Absolutely. And we've pulled together quite a bit of material for this scholarly analyses, historical context pieces, essentially trying to give you a really solid understanding of this text and its author.
Exactly. Our mission today, if you like, is threefold. First, who was Sheriff Feksani Bidlisi, the man behind the book? What was his life like?
What shaped him?
Right. Second, the book itself, what's actually in the sheriff name. We want to go beyond just saying it's important and look at, you know, its contents, its structure.
Get into the details.
And third, the world he lived in. Yeah. That whole 16th century context, Kurdistan caught between these massive empires. You can't really understand the book without understanding that backdrop.
It's crucial. So think of this as maybe a comprehensive guide, a shortcut, perhaps, to understanding a really pivotal period and, well, a vital piece of cultural heritage.
We hope it gives you a solid grasp of why this book matters so much, both then and now.
So let's start with the author, Sheriff Feksani Bidlisi.
Born 1543. His life story alone is, well, pretty incredible. Where do we begin with his early years?
Well, the first thing that jumps out is his background, his lineage. He was born near Qom, in central Iran, which is interesting because his family...
They weren't originally from there.
No, not at all. They were Roshki, from the Roshki tribe, and they were the hereditary rulers of the Emirate of Bitlis, that's southwest of Lake Van, a really significant Kurdish principality.
So nobility. He preferred the title Mir or Emir, right, prince.
Exactly. And his father, Mir Shamsaddin, was actually the exiled Emir of Bitlis when Sheriff Feks was born. So born into this Kurdish ruling family, but crucially in exile.
Exile. That adds another layer. And his mother's side adds even more complexity.
It does. His mother was the daughter of Emir Khan Morlo. He was a Turkic notable connected with the Safavids.
Ah, the Safavids. So right from birth, you see these connections, Kurdish heritage, but also links to the Turkic Safavid world.
It really foreshadows the complex political world he'd have to navigate later on.
Let's talk about that exile. Why was his father, Mir Shamsaddin, exiled from Bitlis in the first place?
Well, it goes back to the Ottomans. Around the 1530s, Sultan Suleiman the Sirth, the Magnificent, decided he wanted to remove Shamsaddin as governor of Bitlis.
Just like that, replace him.
Seems so. He offered Shamsaddin Malatya as compensation. But Shamsaddin clearly saw this as a snub, a challenge to his family's hereditary right to rule Bitlis.
So he refused Malatya.
He did. And instead, he made a really bold move. He turned to the Ottomans' main rival, the Safavid Empire.
Wow. So he switched allegiances.
Completely. Yeah. And the Safavid ruler, Shah Tahmasp I, welcomed him, gave him the title Khan, which was a significant honor, and appointed him governor of various places in Iran, Sirah, Moraga, places like that.
Mm.
Far from Bitlis, though.
So, Sharafzan spent his earliest years growing up entirely within the Safavid sphere because of his father's political choices.
Precisely. His formative years were shaped by this exile, by the fact that Ottoman power had pushed his family out of their homeland. He was living the consequences of that big Ottoman-Safavid rivalry right from the start.
It must have made a huge impression.
Undoubtedly.
Yeah.
And that experience only deepened when, around age 9, maybe 1551 or 52, he was actually sent to the Safavid royal court.
To the Shah's court in Qazvin.
Yes, under Shah Kamas' personal patronage. Imagine that, a young Kurdish noble being educated right alongside Safavid princes and the kids of other top families. It was a major opportunity within that system.
What kind of education are we talking about? What did they teach him there?
It was pretty comprehensive, very much a Persianate courtly education. So,
yeah.
Yes, the Quran, Islamic law, Sharia ethics, piety, the religious fundamentals were important.
But not just that.
Oh, no, far from it. He got extensive training in martial skills, too. Things essential for the ruling class back then. Archery, polo, racing, swordsmanship.
The skills of a warrior prince.
Exactly. And also the ideals of, well, chivalry. Things like humanism, generosity. There's even a suggestion Shah Kamasp encouraged him to learn painting.
Really? Painting too? So a very broad education. Military, religious, artistic.
And crucially, languages.
Mm-hmm.
He mastered Persian.
Which was essential, wasn't it? The lingua franca.
Absolutely. Hmm. Persian was the language of culture, administration, literature, everything. Across that whole region, even into parts of the Ottoman Empire. His fluency was key.
So you have this dual influence. His Kurdish heritage, his family's connection to Bitlis, but nurtured within this very high-level Persianate Safavid court environment.
That's the perfect way to put it.
Yeah.
And understanding that dual heritage is vital to understanding why years later, he'd write this massive history of the Kurds.
Yeah.
But write it in Persian.
Okay, so he gets his top-tier education. He doesn't just stay a scholar, though. He gets into Safavid service pretty young.
Remarkably young. Around age 12, maybe 1554 or 55, he starts his career in statesmanship. His father had retired by then, and apparently the Rajki tribe back home petitioned the Shah to appoint young Sheriff Zan as their chief.
At 12.
Well, nominally appointed. He was likely still too young to rule directly, so he was initially placed under a kind of guardianship or tutelage in Shirvan, a region near the Caspian Sea. But he quickly moved up. He held positions like Prince of Salyan and Mohammedabad, also in Shirvan. Important administrative roles.
And he proved himself militarily, too, not just an administrator.
Definitely. He really made a name for himself during a campaign in Gilan that was around 1567-68. There was a rebellion led by someone called Ahmad Khan, and Sheriff Zan was instrumental in putting it down, showed real leadership.
So his reputation was growing.
It was. He served as a governor in various Safavid areas for, maybe 15, 20 years, often working alongside these Kizilbash emirs.
The Kizilbash, they were the Turkoman tribal backbone of the early Safavid military. Yeah. Powerful figures.
Very powerful. And his career really peaked in 1576. Shah Ismail II came to the throne and gave him a huge title, Amir al-Amara.
Commander of commanders.
Essentially, yes. Specifically, commanders of all Kurdish tribes within the Safavid territory. He became the main guy representing Kurdish interests at the Safavid court.
That sounds like the height of influence. So why the dramatic switch? Why defect to the Ottomans?
Well, even with that high title, things weren't entirely smooth.
Mm.
There seems to have been growing friction, maybe intrigue, involving those powerful Kizilbash factions. Perhaps they saw this prominent Kurdish emir as a rival. Or maybe they were just suspicious of his influence.
Internal politics at court.
Seems likely. Then, around 1577 or 78, Shah Ismail II appointed him governor of Nakhchivan over in Azerbaijan.
Was that a promotion?
Sheriff Zan certainly didn't see it that way. He apparently viewed it as a demotion, a way to get him out of the center of power, push him further away from his Kurdish base and his ancestral lands, almost like an expulsion. There might have been other tensions, too, maybe accusations. It's not entirely clear.
And the timing of this move was critical.
Extremely critical.
Yeah.
Because this happened right around the time the next big Ottoman-Safavid war kicked off. The one from 1578 to 1590.
Ah, so the Ottomans are watching this.
You bet they were. They were likely well aware of his dissatisfaction, and they saw a golden opportunity. A high-ranking Safavid commander, a respected Kurdish emir, unhappy with the Shah.
Too good to pass up.
Exactly. Figures already loyal to the Ottomans, like Khazra Khan, the Ottoman governor of Van, apparently made contact. They knew he was unhappy, knew his strategic value, and basically made him an offer. His location in Nakhchivan also put him close to the Ottoman border.
So he took the offer.
He did. In December 1578, he defected, crossing into Ottoman territory with a significant number of followers, maybe 400 to 600 people.
And the Ottomans rolled out the red carpet.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
He was received with great honor. Sultan Mir III gave him the title of Emir or Khan. Sources vary slightly, and most importantly for Sherazan, the Sultan restored him to his hereditary position as governor of Bitlis.
His family's emirate. That must have been huge for him.
Absolutely. It was the ultimate prize. And in return, Sherazan became a loyal Ottoman commander. He actively fought against the Safavids in that ongoing war, campaigning for the Ottomans for about 10 years, from 1578 to 1588.
Proving his loyalty to his new masters.
Yes. And his service was rewarded further. Around 1583, the Ottomans also gave him control over the nearby district of Mush, adding to his power base in the region.
It really drives home how fluid loyalties could be back then. It wasn't about, say, modern ethnic nationalism. It was about pragmatism, opportunity, grievances.
Exactly. Survival and advantage. His father had switched to the Safavids when it suited him. Sheriff Zan switched to the Ottomans when circumstances changed. It was the reality for many Kurdish leaders caught between these two giants.
Okay, so he's back in Bitlis, ruling as an Ottoman emir. What about his later life? How did he transition from governor to historian?
He governed Bitlis for a good number of years under Ottoman authority. Then, in 1597-1005, in the Islamic calendar, when he was about 53 or 54, he took a significant step. He formally transferred the governorship of Bitlis to his son, Shams al-Din.
And this is when he says he retired to write the sheriff name.
That's his version of events, yes.
Yeah.
In the book itself, he presents it as a voluntary retirement from the day-to-day burdens of ruling, specifically to dedicate himself to scholarship and writing his history.
But historians sometimes question that narrative.
Some do. There's speculation, based on analysis of the context, that it might not have been entirely voluntary. Perhaps there were growing tensions with the Ottoman central government, maybe disputes over tax revenues or how he was administering Bitlis. A sort of forced retirement is possible.
Interesting. Hard to know for sure.
Very hard. But whatever the exact reason, it's clear that around this time, 1597, coinciding with him stepping back from direct rule, he completed the serif name.
And he lived a few more years after that.
Yes, he died around 1603 or 1604, reportedly in Bitlis, where he's thought to be buried. Though, as with many dates from this period, you sometimes see slight variations, like 1599 or 160 or 102 mentioned.
A life really defined by politics, exile, warfare, and then culminating in this massive scholarly project. It makes sense now to pivot to the wider world he was writing in, that 16th century context.
Absolutely essential. You cannot understand the Sheriff Name or Sheriff Rexon's life without understanding 16th century Kurdistan and the overwhelming impact of that Ottoman-Safavid rivalry.
It really dominated everything, didn't it?
Completely. The entire century was shaped by the struggle between the Sunni Ottomans and the Shia Safavids and Kurdistan. Geographically, it's right in the middle. Yeah. A critical frontier zone.
And a constant battleground.
Frequently, yes. But it wasn't just about territory. There was that huge religious dimension, too. The Safavids made Twelver Shiism the state religion, which was a direct challenge to the Ottomans, who saw themselves as the protectors of Sunni Islam.
And most Kurds were Sunni.
The majority were, yes.
Yeah.
So that religious fault line often played into political allegiances. Kurdish leaders had to consider that aspect when deciding which empire to align with or try to play off against the other.
We mentioned the Battle of Chaldiran earlier, in 1514. That was a huge moment.
A turning point. The Ottoman victory really cemented their control over much of eastern Anatolia, including large Kurdish areas. But it didn't end the conflict. It just set the stage for decades more of intermittent warfare.
And the impact on the Kurdish regions themselves must have been immense.
Devastating, often. These lands were vital supply routes, recruitment grounds, and yes, battlefields. Both sides sometimes used really harsh tactics, scorched earth policies, to deny resources to the enemy, for instance.
And population transfers, too. Moving people around.
Yes, that happened. Shah Abbas III of the Safavids famously moved large numbers of Kurds eastward to Khorasan, partly to secure that border region, partly perhaps to weaken potential opposition closer to the Ottoman frontier. The human cost of this imperial rivalry was immense for the local populations.
So for the Kurdish emirs, the rulers of these local principalities, it was a constant tightrope walk.
An incredibly delicate balancing act. They were constantly assessing threats, opportunities, trying to figure out which alignment offered the best chance of survival or autonomy. The Ottomans, after Chaldiran, were quite smart about cultivating alliances with Sunni Kurdish leaders. Think of Idris Bitlisi, who helped integrate many emirates into the Ottoman system.
And the Safavids had their own methods too, right? Like Sheriff Exen's education at their court.
Exactly. They used patronage, education, appointments, recognition of hereditary titles, different tools to manage the Kurdish populations, and leaders within their sphere.
Kurdistan wasn't a unified entity, though. It was made up of all these different emirates.
That's key. It was this complex mosaic of principalities, the Mirnishin, based often on tribal ties, ruled by hereditary dynasties, Mirs, Begs, Khans. You had Bitlis, Hakkari, Botan, Soran, Boban, Ardalan, loads of them. Each with its own interests.
And the Ottomans used this fragmentation.
To their advantage, yes. After Chaldiran, they set up this system called Yurtluk Okakluk for many loyal Kurdish emirs. Essentially, it granted them hereditary rule over their territories, like fiefdoms.
With a degree of autonomy.
Considerable autonomy, actually, in local affairs. They could manage their territory, collect taxes, maintain their own armed followers.
In exchange for what?
In exchange for acknowledging Ottoman overlordship, pledging loyalty, providing soldiers for Ottoman campaigns, and sometimes paying tribute. The main Ottoman administrative hub overseeing much of this was the islet of Diyarbakir.
So it was a way for the Ottomans to govern this tricky frontier region indirectly. Secure loyalty against the Safavids without having to administer every village themselves.
Exactly. It was a pragmatic solution. Leverage the existing Kurdish power structures for imperial goals.
But we need to be careful not to overstate this autonomy. It wasn't independence.
Absolutely not. They were still vassals, whether to the Ottomans or the Safavids. Their status was always precarious, always dependent on the bigger imperial picture. Loyalty brought rewards, like Sheriff Exen getting Bitlis back. Disloyalty, or even perceived disloyalty, could mean deposition, exile or worse.
And the empires could play the Emirates off against each other.
Classic divide and conquer. Exploiting rivalries between Kurdish principalities was a standard tactic for both Istanbul and Isfahan.
So when people sometimes talk about this period as a golden age of Kurdish self-rule,
it needs a lot of qualification. It's understandable why later generations, especially with the rise of nationalism, might look back and see a time of greater Kurdish agency. But it was autonomy within an imperial system, granted largely because of the Ottoman-Safavid conflict. It wasn't Kurdish sovereignty as we think of it today.
It served the empire's purposes.
Primarily, yes. It was a system based on mutual obligations, but the empires held the ultimate power. And, as we know, when the Ottomans started centralizing more in the 19th century, this semi-autonomous status was largely dismantled.
Sharafaksan getting Bitlis back because he defected really illustrates how conditional it all was.
Perfectly. His story is a case study in the realities of that era.
Speaking of Bitlis, let's use it as that case study. What does its specific story tell us?
Well, Bitlis, Harifexen's home emirate ruled by his Rojki family, was strategically vital. It had this long history of Kurdish rule, but in the early 16th century, its control flipped Aykoyunlu, then Safavids briefly, then Ottomans after 1548.
And then Harifexen's father lost it to the Ottomans, defected to the Safavids.
And Sharafzadeh himself only got it back decades later by defecting from the Safavids to the Ottomans. It shows just how contested that territory was. Bitlis was a significant emirate. It had military clout. It was involved in regional trade, had an Armenian minority too.
And culturally. Even when under Ottoman political control, its orientation was different.
Very much so. Culturally, Bitlis remained deeply embedded in the Persian world. Persian was the language of the court, of administration, of literature, scholarship, diplomacy. Figures like Idris Bitlisi and Sharafaksan himself were part of this Persian literary tradition in Bitlis.
Even while being Ottoman vassals.
Yes. That cultural connection linked Kurdish courts like Bitlis into this vast intellectual network stretching across Persia and beyond. And that, again, is why Sharafaks, writing a history of the Kurds, chose Persian as his medium. It was the language of high culture and administration he knew best, and the one that would reach the widest influential audience.
Which brings us squarely back to the sheriff name itself, written around 1597 during his retirement. What did he say his reasons were for writing it?
In the book's introduction, he's quite clear. He says he felt that previous historians, mostly Persian and Arab, had neglected the history of the Kurds. He wanted to rectify that, to preserve the memory of Kurdish rulers, dynasties, tribes, important figures, so their deeds wouldn't be forgotten.
A noble goal, to fill a perceived historical gap.
On the surface, yes. But most scholars agree there were likely other, more political motivations bubbling underneath.
Such as?
Well, by carefully documenting the lineages and histories of these Kurdish ruling families, especially his own Rodiki dynasty, he was inherently asserting their status, their legitimacy, their right to rule. In that era, history and genealogy were politics.
So it was a statement of prestige, aimed at whom?
Aimed at multiple audiences, probably. Other Kurdish elites, certainly. But also the Ottoman authorities and the wider Persian illiterate world. It was a way of saying, look at our long history, our noble lineage, our importance. Some even argue as an implicit defense of the whole system of semi-autonomous Kurdish emirates under Ottoman protection, the system he himself benefited from.
That makes sense. And the choice of Persian, as we discussed, fits that goal of reaching a wide, influential audience?
Exactly. It wasn't denying his Kurdish identity. It was a strategic choice based on the linguistic realities of power and culture at the time. Persian was the language to use if you wanted your work read and taken seriously by the elites across the region. Plus, there wasn't really a standardized written Kurdish suitable for such a massive historical work back then.
Okay, let's get into the nitty-gritty, the content. What's actually written in the sheriff name? Can you walk us through its structure and what it covers?
Sure. It's generally organized quite logically. There's an introduction, the mukaddima. Then the main body is typically divided into four main parts, or sections the term uses offer at lofa, like books or pages. And finally, a conclusion, the katima.
Though some sources mention two bigger volumes initially planned.
There's some mention of that, yeah, one volume on Kurdish history, another maybe on contemporary Ottoman and Persian rulers. But the text, as we mostly have it today, focuses overwhelmingly on the Kurds.
So those four main parts, what does each one cover?
Okay, part one generally deals with five major Kurdish dynasties that, at various points, claimed actual royalty, sultanate, or something close to independence. This usually includes the Marwanids of Diyarbakir, the Hasanwe heads around Dinavar, the Fadluids of Greater Luristan, the Atabegs of Little Luristan, and probably the most famous internationally, the Ayyubid Saladin's dynasty.
Right, Saladin. So major historical dynasties. What about part two?
Part two shifts to Kurdish rulers who maybe didn't claim full kingship but still wielded significant sovereign powers, like the right to mint their own coins or have the Friday prayer sermon, the khutbah, read in their name. These were important markers of authority in the Islamic world.
Got it. So slightly different levels of power. Then part three.
Part three broadens the scope further. It covers the histories of many other hereditary governors, ruling families, mirs, begs, across various parts of Kurdistan. It's more of a survey of the wider landscape of Kurdish principalities.
And the final part, part four, that was more personal.
Very much so. Part four is a detailed history of the emirs of Bitlis, focusing specifically on Sheriff Eksan's own ancestors, the Rajki line. And crucially, this part includes his autobiography.
Ah, so we get his own story in his own words.
To a large extent, yes. It's an invaluable source for understanding his life and perspective.
What about the introduction and conclusion? What do they add?
The introduction's really interesting. He apparently includes some reflections on what he saw as Kurdish characteristics, sometimes critical, actually, mentioning things like disunity or lack of foresight. He lays out his reasons for writing the book, and he also offers his definition of Kurdistan, its geography, as he understood it in the late 1500s.
And the conclusion?
The conclusion is often problematic in the manuscripts. It seems frequently missing or incomplete. But presumably it would have summarized the work and offered some final thoughts.
So the scope is huge, geographically and chronologically.
Definitely. It stretches from almost legendary pre-Islamic ancestors right up to his own time in the late 1590s, focusing most heavily on the medieval and early modern periods. It covers Kurdish life, social structures, the histories of principalities across a vast area, eastern Anatolia, Mesopotamia, the Caucasus, western Iran. It's incredibly rich.
But you mentioned earlier, it's not totally exhaustive. There are gaps.
That's an important point scholars raise. For example, the Milan Tribal Confederation, who are pretty significant, don't get much coverage. Why? Was it an oversight? Did he not have the information? Or were there political reasons for leaving them out? We don't really know. And as I said, some chapters might just be unfinished.
When he was putting all this together, what was his process? What sources did he use?
He definitely drew on earlier written histories, chronicles in Arabic and Persian, following the general traditions of Islamic historical writing. That was standard practice.
But he added his own experience, too.
Yes, and that's what makes it unique. He wove in information from his own long career in Safavid and Ottoman service, things he witnessed firsthand, and accounts he gathered from his network of contacts among Kurdish nobles and officials. Eyewitness information.
And his method? Was it just listing kings and battles?
Largely, yes. It follows that traditional focus on political events, military campaigns, dynastic succession. That was the standard model for historiography then. But, as mentioned, that introductory discussion of Kurdish ethnic or social traits is a bit unusual, a notable addition.
We always need to read historical texts critically, though. What about potential biases in the sheriff name?
Absolutely crucial. Given that he wrote it after defecting to the Ottomans and being reinstated in Bitlis by them, a pro-Ottoman slant is almost certainly present. He had patrons to please, and his own recent history was tied to the Ottomans.
So how might that show up?
You'd expect events involving the Ottomans and Safavids to be presented in a way favorable to the Ottomans, maybe portraying the Sultan as the great defender of Sunni Islam against the heretical Safavids, and depicting Kurds primarily as loyal Ottoman subjects. His personal experiences and political alignment would inevitably color his narrative.
And his focus on legitimizing Kurdish rulers, especially his own family.
That's another potential bias. He might have embellished achievements, downplayed failures, or presented certain lineages in a particularly favorable light to bolster their claims to status and power. Even his comments on Kurdish disunity need context. Was he genuinely observing, or was it a way to implicitly argue for strong leadership like his own family's under Ottoman oversight?
So it's this foundational, incredibly valuable text, but also very much a document of its time shaped by the author's life and agenda.
Exactly. Which leads us right into thinking about its significance, how it's been interpreted, and its legacy over the centuries. There's no argument that it's the single most important native written source we have for Kurdish history before modern times.
In a field where sources can be scarce,
it's indispensable. It gives us names, dates, lineages, details about political geography, glimpses of society that we just wouldn't have otherwise. It's rightly seen as the starting point for Kurdish historiography.
But then its meaning and importance really shifted or expanded later on, didn't it, with the rise of modern Kurdish nationalism?
Dramatically so. Starting in late 19th and early 20th centuries, as Kurdish national consciousness began to form, the Sherf name took on immense symbolic weight.
How so?
It became a cornerstone for building a modern Kurdish national story. Nationalists pointed to it as proof, hard evidence of a long, distinct Kurdish identity, a historical claim to a homeland, and a history of self-governance, or at least aspirations towards it.
Those accounts of the powerful emirates became precedent.
Exactly. They were seen as proof that Kurds had ruled themselves in the past and therefore had the right and capacity to do so again. That era of the semi-autonomous principalities described by Sherif Eksen started being viewed, perhaps somewhat nostalgically, as a golden age.
And Sherif Eksen himself became a hero figure.
A national patriot, absolutely.
Yeah.
The man who recorded and celebrated Kurdish history. You see cultural centers, institutions named after him today. The book became a vital touchstone, a source of pride and historical legitimacy for early Kurdish cultural and political movements.
So its publication and translation could even be political acts.
Definitely. Getting the text out there, making it accessible, was part of asserting that national narrative.
Modern historians, though, tend to approach that connection between the Sherif name and nationalism a bit more cautiously.
Yes, there's a strong emphasis now on avoiding anachronism. While acknowledging the book's huge importance, scholars warn against reading 21st century ideas of nationalism back into a 16th century text.
Because concepts like the nation-state, popular sovereignty, they weren't really Sherif Eksen's world.
Not in the way we understand them. So rather than seeing it purely through a modern nationalist lens, many scholars talk about it reflecting an early modern form of Kurdish ethnopolitics.
Ethnopolitics, meaning?
Meaning it shows a clear awareness of a shared Kurdish identity, based on things like lineage, language, territory, customs. But the politics of the time were conducted through the frameworks of dynastic rule, tribal structures, and those big imperial rivalries. It was politics with an ethnic dimension, but not modern ethnic nationalism.
And it's important not to forget that pro-Ottoman angle we discussed.
Crucial. He wrote it as an Ottoman mirror. The text often frames things favorably for the Ottomans, praises the Sultan, criticizes the Safavids. That reflects his reality, his patronage. You have to see it as partly a product of his political goal, legitimizing his own dynasty and defending that system of Kurdish emirates under Ottoman protection.
It's fascinating how the same text can be used differently over time.
It really is. Sherif Eksen used history for 16th century politics, dynastic claims, imperial maneuvering. Centuries later, nationalists highlighted the parts about Kurdish identity and rule, often downplaying the vassal status or the pro-Ottoman bits, to build a case for modern nationhood.
It shows how history writing itself is an act of interpretation, doesn't it? And how those interpretations can be shaped by later needs.
Absolutely. And because the political status of Kurds remains such a live issue today, the Kurdish question, the Sherif name itself, remains a somewhat politicized text.
How does that manifest now?
Well, interpretations are still contested. What does it really mean for Kurdish identity, for historical claims to land or autonomy? You even see controversy around modern translations.
Like the Izzedi translation you mentioned.
Right. Mirdad Izadi's 2005 English version, titled The Sherifname, or The History of the Kurdish Nation. That title itself, Kurdish Nation, drew criticism from some scholars for imposing that modern concept. There were also accusations about some of the commentary being anachronistic or even containing factual errors or questionable interpretations, like his theories about Yazdanism.
So the debates continue.
They do. It highlights how difficult it can be to separate historical analysis from present-day political concerns when dealing with a text this significant to a group's identity and aspirations.
One last crucial point about the text itself. Despite its importance and all these translations over the years, we still don't have a definitive modern edition.
It's quite remarkable, isn't it? It's been translated into German, Russian, French, Arabic, Turkish, English, Kurdish dialects. The first big scholarly edition in Persian, with a Russian translation, was by Veliaminov Zernov back in the 1860s, then Charmoy's French translation in the 1870s. There were even early Turkish translations circulating in Kurdish courts in the 1600s.
Showing its immediate relevance.
Yes. But that foundational Vilyam and Abzarov edition is based on only about 6 manuscripts, and it lacks the kind of detailed critical apparatus comparing variations between manuscripts, detailed notes that modern scholarship really requires for a text this complex.
So scholars are calling for a new edition.
But they have been for a long time, and there have been projects initiated. There are dozens of manuscript copies scattered in libraries around the world. A truly modern critical edition, based on comparing as many of those as possible, would be a massive undertaking, but incredibly valuable.
It would provide a much more reliable Persian text as a basis for all future research and translation.
Exactly. It's a surprising gap, given the Zhurif name's status.
So wrapping this all up, our deep dive shows the Zhurif name isn't just some dusty old chronicle. It's deeply tied to the incredible life of its author, Shahrsaneh Bedlisi, a figure navigating treacherous imperial politics.
A product of that incredibly turbulent 16th century world.
And while it's this invaluable source for Kurdish history, its meaning and significance have continued to evolve, sparking debate right up to the present day.
Its journey from a 16th century dynastic history, written with specific political aims, to becoming a key text in modern national identity narratives is really quite extraordinary.
It really makes you think. Here's something maybe to mull over. How does a text like this, born from a specific moment and specific motivations centuries ago, continue to resonate and shape identities and even political goals today?
What does that tell us about the power stories, the power of historical narratives?
And maybe about the importance of engaging with them critically, understanding their origins as best we can. We definitely encourage you to look further into the Zhurif name and the rich, complex history it represents.
There's always more to discover.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.